Welcome, everyone, to today's presentation, Parallels in Financial Crises. My name is Marianne Rodriguez, and I'm a program associate with the Capitol Hill Campus Program that's run by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the organization, we're an economic research and outreach organization based out of Arlington, Virginia, with George Mason University, and we aim to connect policymakers to the economic knowledge that is found in the academic setting. As a few notes, we do have session surveys. Please take a minute to fill those out to help us review our programs. They really do provide great feedback on the things that we're doing and how we can improve. We do have a few pens available. If you didn't bring one, just see us at the back table. Second of all, we'll have a few more courses coming up. Next Monday, we'll be having a breakfast session with Dr. Russ Roberts to look at his new book, The Price of Everything. So I hope you'll be able to join us on a Monday morning. There will be a continental breakfast served. And we also have a regulatory studies panel coming up in November. And we're putting together details on that. And finally, I have to make an announcement that regrettably, tomorrow's presentation on the Great Depression with Dr. Gary Richardson had to be canceled due to unforeseen circumstances. And we will try to address the topic at a later date, possibly in the coming months. But right now, I wanted to welcome Dr. Garrett Jones. He is an assistant professor of economics at George Mason University. And previously, he worked with Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville and the University of California in San Diego. And at one time, he even worked on Capitol Hill. And now he studies monetary policy and financial aspects of the economy, and so can you please give a warm welcome to Dr. Garrett Jones.
Well, what just happened? First, as some of you have noticed, over the last 10 years we had a big increase in home prices. Unprecedented in U.S. history to have a rise that went up so fast. And a lot of people told stories about how this was a perfectly rational response to market forces. You'll notice that this beginning point here, this comes from my colleague Alex Tabarrok's op-ed in the New York Times, which came in March of this year. You'll notice the starting date here for the U.S. big rise in home prices right around 1997, when Congress passed laws making it much easier to buy and sell homes without having to pay capital gains taxes on the increase. A lot of people started getting into buying and selling homes, improving them, and home prices started going up. So notice that the increase started way back when interest rates were actually kind of high. Prices rose dramatically, and then they just kind of kept going, especially when interest rates got low, the increases kept going. It peaked around 2005, 2006, depending on who's doing the counting. And over the last year or so, prices have declined slightly. Why do I say slightly? Everybody notices this is the biggest drop in home prices since the Great Depression. Well, it's slightly for two reasons. It's slight compared to how massive the increase was. So if you think we're going to go anywhere back near where we started, we've got a long way to go. And it's especially slight compared to the real world decline in our neighbor to the west, Japan. So Japan in the 80s had a massive real estate bubble. Prices went way, way up and peaked in about 1992 and then plummeted precipitously. And so the Japanese experience lets us know that sometimes what goes up does come down, and comes down over the course of quite a number of years. You'll see the biggest drop occurred in over the course of, say, 2 years in Japan, and then a slight decline afterwards. So this data is from March, this op-ed, and since then it's only come down about that much more from the latest data we have. So we still, between March and now, there was actually a decline, in the rate of home price fall declines. So if we're heading back down anywhere near to the Japanese levels, boy, there's a long way to go. So what's going on now and in the future is that a lot of people are now underwater with their mortgages. That means that the amount they owe on the home is more than it looks like the home can actually sell for any time in the near future. So that's what we mean when we say somebody's underwater in their mortgage. People often say, there are a lot of stories around, floating around about why people are defaulting on their mortgages, why there are a lot of foreclosures. The Boston Fed has done fantastic work investigating some of these claims. If you want to look at it, it's work by folks at Girardi and Willis and their co-authors at the Boston Fed. But basically the Boston Fed has done all of the very tedious, boring work of going into millions of mortgage application documents, checking out real estate prices across the country, actually checking out all the glib generalizations that people like me and people on television like to make. So, turns out, according to the Boston Fed folks, resetting ARMs, people with these low teaser rates that go up and then their payments skyrocket, that doesn't seem to be a really big problem in terms of magnitude. That doesn't explain much of the rise in foreclosures. Similarly, subprime mortgages per se don't seem to be really the problem. If you have a subprime mortgage and you bought your home with a subprime mortgage, say, here or here or here, say 2001, 2002, 2003, your home price has gone up so much that even though prices have come down a bit since, you're probably still in the money. You're probably still above water in your mortgage. So, and there were actually a fair number of subprime mortgages made in the early 2000s. So, if you're trying to predict who's more likely to go ahead and default on their mortgage, to walk away from their mortgage, is it going to be somebody with a subprime mortgage, or is it going to be somebody who's underwater in their mortgage? It's going to be the person who's underwater, which fortunately for economists is just what economic theory would predict, right? People deciding to walk away from mortgages are making a fairly reasoned economic decision. I'm underwater. Boy, it doesn't look like, why am I paying for a $1 million home when it looks like I can only resell it for $500,000? It might be time to rent for a few years. Now, most people with subprimes, most people who are underwater do keep paying their mortgages. But the folks who do walk away are much more likely to be underwater than to just be merely subprime. So the conclusion we can take from this is that since some people are going to be walking away from these underwater mortgages now and in the future, if prices keep falling, then somebody won't get paid. So whoever holds these mortgages isn't going to get the money they thought they were going to get. That's the key fact of this, of the financial crisis, that somebody's not going to get paid. They thought they were going to get a bunch of cushy mortgage payments over the next 10, 20 years and then maybe get the principal paid off. And they're not going to get that now, and that's kind of sad, right? Through the magic of modern finance, those folks who aren't getting paid are all over the economy now, rather than just your local bank. There's some Wall Street firms that held a lot of these mortgages. They're not going to get paid as much as they thought. There are some insurance companies who insure these mortgages who are going to have to kick in now. They're going to have to pay more than they thought. So the key idea, rather than focusing on who's not getting paid, is that somebody's not going to get paid. So if you Google the phrase unprecedented crisis in subprime, you get a lot of hits, okay? But ours is emphatically not an unprecedented crisis. As the chart, as the previous chart indicates, Japan went through the same kind of thing. They had a real estate bubble, went up really high, they bought Rockefeller Center, now known as 30 Rock because of the television popularization of the place. They did a lot of things during this real estate bubble, grew a lot, but then it burst. The Japanese government responded with a very aggressive system of bailouts and regulatory interventions. They bought up some bad loans. First, they started off by just encouraging businesses to buy off bad loans from other banks. Later on, they actually created a program for buying bad loans, for the government to buy bad loans directly. They did some, the government has actually bought some shares in troubled banks. The government rewrote accounting rules to help banks. Some of this was implicit. Bank regulators, it's their job to go in and check out and make sure that the bank is actually sound, that they're actually going to get repaid. And so, bank regulators would go into the banks and say, these loans you have, looks like some of these people are kind of behind in their payments. And the bank would say, yeah, but we promise they're going to pay back. We promise. And the regulator said, okay, that's good enough. So that was a common Japanese form of relaxing the accounting rules, an implicit relaxation. It's another way to call it is you could say that their loans were marked to make believe, right? So we'll just pretend that this $1 million loan is actually going to pay off. That's gone on for a number of years. That went on for a number of years in Japan. One way that these loans actually did pay off is that the government would let the banks know, well, why don't you just kind of keep servicing that loan? So the bank would tell the manufacturer, okay, you've got a $1 million loan that's due in 5 years. I know you're having some, you might have some trouble repaying it. How about I give you another $1 million loan to pay that off? Give you a 10-year $1 million loan. The manufacturer says, okay. So rolling over bad loans is one way to make bad loans look very good on your balance sheet. That keeps the regulators happy. It prevents a lot of job losses. That makes, you know, voters happy. And that keeps politicians happy. So there was a big unwillingness to let bad banks fail. People in Japan decided that was bad for confidence. Confidence, you hear that word a lot. So some of this might sound familiar to you. Maybe it's happened in some other industrialized country you've heard of. The net result of these kinds of policies and the Japanese experience was they had a lost decade. So again, lost decade, another one of these phrases that's widely used in the economics literature. So they had a decade of 1% average growth in real output, far below their old average, and far below the trend of other rich countries. So how does a bursting bubble create a lost decade for Japan? So, the U.S. had a recent bubble that burst. NASDAQ went up by a couple of factors, the tech bubble, and it's almost completely collapsed, right? But the collapse of pets.com did not send off shockwaves that threaten the very fabric of our financial system. So why is it that some kinds of bubble collapses seem to cause big problems and some bubble collapses cause small problems? The standard explanation, the absolutely standard off-the-shelf explanation for maybe half of the Japanese problem, is that the Japanese government responded to its financial crisis by creating a massive government program to create zombies. So the other half of their solution involved bad monetary policy. Most economists now think the Japanese, pretty comfortable saying the Japanese monetary policy was pretty too tight in response to the collapse of the bubble. But that's a job for the other side of the mall, so not for you. So I'll focus on the sort of legislative side of things. So zombies is a term widely used in the literature for banks or businesses that have huge debts and low productivity and that they're kept alive through government support, whether explicit government support through low interest loans or implicit government support by regulators looking the other way or coming up with creative accounting rules that help you say, oh yeah, those mortgages, yeah, they're really worth a lot. Yeah, I'm sure it's all just a big misunderstanding. They're probably worth a lot. I'm sure they are. Your word's good enough for me. So what zombie banks did is they decided to keep hope alive. And what they did is they renewed a lot of old loans, as I already said, and that created zombie firms. So firms know, wow, whether I do a good job or a bad job, I'm pretty much going to get my loan renewed. Why? Because the bank who's lending me this money is under pressure from their regulator. So it's not as though this completely shuts down the urge to innovate. It's not as though this completely shuts down the urge to try out new things, to expand into new markets, to make more profits. It just weakens that effect. So these firms that are get infected with the zombie virus have to ask themselves, it's very easy to see why they chose to get infected, right? Because why do you want to tell stockholders you made bad loans? And why do banks want to tell the regulators that they made bad loans? So there's no sort of, economists often throw around words like contagion and infection and disease spreading without really taking the time to explain what's really going on here. There really are economic choices that explain why banks turn into zombies, and then why the firms who get those loans turn into zombies. And you might think, well, why can't we just let these zombies go along? I mean, that can be, it's good to save people's jobs. It's good for people to have, you know, good jobs. And you don't like people being unemployed, and you don't want home prices to decline. And so why don't we just kind of keep these zombies going on and maybe come up with a nicer word for zombies? That might be a good way to solve the problem. Well, one problem is that we know we have our best data on this from the U.S., but around the world we have now good data from all the rich countries. And we know now that job destruction is an important part of economic progress. In the average month, this is a standard fact, in the average U.S. month, about 2 million jobs that get destroyed and about 2.1 million jobs that get created. So a lot of people breaking up with employment relationships and starting new employment relationships all the time. So that's about 2% of all jobs getting created or destroyed in a given month. And on average, the amount that get created is just a little bit bigger than the amount that gets destroyed. Just a small gap of about 100,000 jobs on average, maybe a little more than that. And that net rise, that difference between the 2 million and the 2.1 million is what we get excited about when the government reports so many new jobs were created last month, so many jobs were lost last month. That's just a difference. That's just an accounting identity, a gap between all of the creation and all of the destruction. And so the term that economists now often use to get ourselves to think about this is that there's a lot of churn in the U.S. economy. So as John Haltwanger, University of Maryland, who did the, again, very tedious, boring work of assembling data on this, and he did it well over, now going on 20 years now, he started doing this. First, he started off working with U.S. manufacturing firms, then eventually expanded it. The research became so popular that he's developed quite a career going around consulting in the other rich countries, helping them to create measures of how much churn is going on, trying to use survey data, new kinds of surveys to find out about how big the flows are of people between jobs. So there's a lot of churn, but what does that matter for our living standards? Well, most of the long-run growth in productivity, as far as we can tell, is due to this churn. New firms seem to, over the long haul, this is over 10-year periods. You have to look over about a 10-year period to really see this. If you're waiting for things to show up in 3, 6, 9 months, you know, I can't help you with that. That's not my gig. But new firms seem to create about 25% of the growth in living standards over about a 10-year period. Small firms that seem really productive and start hiring a lot of people pretty quickly. So the second factor, so that's about a fourth of it, of growth in living standards. Another 35% is that some firms start getting better. They're kind of sitting around doing okay. And then something happens and they just start getting better. Maybe they bring in a new consultant. Maybe they bring in some management. Maybe their researchers come up with a new invention. Maybe their workers come up with some really great technique for how to be more efficient and how to keep your customers happier. But the fact that a third of living standards is coming from more output of these better firms, that's a pretty big deal. So what happens in a growing economy is that people flow out of the less productive firms, where I'm sure the people are all very nice. So, I mean, the Dunder Mifflins of the world are filled with very nice people, right? And they're just not doing very much for the economy, right? So it would be a lot nice if we had less of that. It would be good if we had less of that. So we want people flowing out of those kinds of firms into firms where people are actually getting something done. So if zombies persist, and this seems to be what economists have sort of figured out over the last decade, and especially in looking at Japan, is that if zombies persist, too many people work at these low productivity businesses. You know, they basically spend their day checking their email and playing Minesweeper and watching stuff on YouTube. And it's a great way to live your life. I mean, it's almost like being, you've got a sinecure, right? So, but what that means for society as a whole is that you've got lower living standards. So, but nobody, it seems kind of unpopular to issue those pink slips. So why is it hard to kill zombies? Well, economists have put a lot of research into this. And it's pretty clear that the right time to be tough is always later. It's just like the right day to start going to the gym is always when? It's tomorrow. It's always tomorrow. You get to tomorrow and you're like, well, the right day to do it now is tomorrow. Day after that, right day to start going to the gym is tomorrow. So the right time to be a bad cop, similarly, is later. Especially when there's innocent bystanders that will certainly be hurt. That's what happens when you destroy these zombie firms, or when you sort of encourage them to shut down, or when you encourage them to go into bankruptcy and put the debt holders in charge, see if they can run it. All these things are tough, and some innocent bystanders get hurt. And especially when it's right before an election, it's especially hard to be tough. So fortunately, we have a Nobel Prize-winning model that helps explain a little of this more carefully. Finn Kidlin and Ed Prescott won their Nobel in part. About half of the reason was for their work on the time consistency of delay. So let me explain a little about time consistency. So governments really don't want people to live in flood areas as a rule, right? They really don't want people to live in flood areas. So one thing governments often do is they try to say, well, if you live in the flood, they could say, if you live in a flood area and the home gets flooded out, your home gets flooded, we're not going to repay. We're not going to rebuild you. If people really knew that was true, then they wouldn't do this bad thing. They wouldn't build their home in the floodplain. But we all know what's going to happen, right? The people are going to build the people are going to see through the government statement. They're going to say, like, the government's just bluffing. They're going to build their home in the floodplain. And there's going to be a flood. And then, you know, the president flies over in a helicopter and says, oh, this is so sad. We need to help these people and rebuild their homes. So forward-looking behavior on the part of consumers makes people decide to do things that are costly to the rest of us. So similarly, it's surprising that sometimes that governments actually do keep their promises. For example, the idea that governments keep their patents keep patent laws is just absolutely amazing to me. You know, I mean, just think of how popular you could be if you just said all the drugs that are patented right now, we're going to all make them generic. All the drugs that are costing you hundreds of dollars per pill, and that are costing your insurance companies, especially hundreds of dollars per pill, we're going to just make them generic, and you know, within a year or so, they'll all be like $5 each. You can imagine that'd be very popular, but yet our government resists the urge to do that. So there are times when the government resists the urge to be time consistent, and instead it behaves time inconsistently. It has self-control. So a lesson from this is that sometimes governments can pull this off and sometimes they can't. So if Congress actually could sign a binding contract to get tough later on some of these firms, if the Japanese Diet could have signed a contract to saying, well, right now we're not going to be tough on our zombie firms, but we're going to sign a contract right now saying that 2 years from now, 18 months from now, we're really going to shut down the firms that are insolvent. We're really going to shut down the firms that are undercapitalized. Or at least we're going to make them go into forced mergers. Or we're at least going to make turn their debt into equity so that the debt holders get a chance at running the firm. They might do that. They might sign a contract to do that. But the problem is that legislatures have a tough time signing binding contracts. Governments do find ways around this. They do find ways around the fact that it's always very tempting for the legislature to do the nice thing now and the tough thing later. And this is part of what Kidlin and Prescott's research has gotten economists and political scientists to think about. We create independent agencies all the time. The Federal Reserve, it's their job to be the bad cop. We create judges, independent judges, who go and tell, just say, put very nice people in jail. We create base closing commissions so that nobody has to actually go up there and say, well, okay, I'm going to vote to, you know, close the base in my own district. You just say, well, I got to take this as an all or nothing package. So governments create a lot of techniques to try to get around this, but in new settings especially, it's very tempting to get tough later. So once an economy has 10, 20 years experience with the situation, they might find something, might work something out, as the Japanese government eventually did after about 10 years. So one question is, will the U.S. create zombies? Will we go down this path? And first let me tell the pro-zombie case, and then I'll tell the anti-zombie case, that maybe we won't create zombies. So one piece of evidence that we might get zombies is that stock prices have gone down. Stock prices are, and especially they went down after we passed the bailout. So the 8 days of terror began the day that the Senate voted to pass the Paulson bailout package. It continued through the day that the House passed the revised bill, and then it continued all the following week. A week that didn't have that much amazingly bad news, so it's hard to figure. It's a little bit of a fool's errand to try to interpret what the market's thinking. But let me at least tell a story. So allow me the permission to give me permission to tell a little story about this. So one reason it might that we might get into a zombie-like situation in the U.S. comes from my colleague Brian Kaplan's idea trap model. He points out that it seems like, on average, bad ideas tend to flourish in bad times. So, and so as a result of bad ideas flourishing during bad times, you get even worse times. So those may be economic, they may be political. So one example of a policy that didn't work out too well was FDR's pro-cartel policy. So one of the parts of the National Recovery Act, which even managed to survive the unconstitutionality of the act, was that FDR created a policy of saying, I will let big businesses set very high prices for their goods. I'll let them form monopolies. Basically, I'll let them form cartels as long as they agree to pay their workers high wages. It sounds like good common sense because you'll get wages up and you'll get prices up. There'll be more profits and workers will be spending more. Good common sense. But Colin Ohanian, in an important and widely cited article in the Journal of Political Economy a few years ago, pointed out that what this did is by creating winners and losers, there were some industries that were cartel industries and other industries that weren't, workers would wait a long time in line hoping to get a job with one of these cartelized industries. So for example, some parts of the U.S. coal industry were cartelized. Some parts of the U.S. coal industry weren't cartelized. You can imagine workers would be very happy to wait a while to try to get a job in the higher wage cartel sector. And Colin Ohanian think that this can't explain all of the U.S.'s slow recovery from the Great Depression. It can't explain all of it. But they think it can explain about a third. So that's just one example of how we got into a bad time. People said, let's try anything, and anything is what we tried. But FDR offers another interesting example of being the bad cop now, doing the exact opposite of this here. And it's important as an illustration of what's going on right now in the U.S. So when FDR came into office, about the previous few weeks, there had been an enormous wave of banking crises. There had been massive bank collapses over the 4 years of the Hoover administration. There seemed to be an especially bad crisis just in the weeks before FDR took office. So when he took office, within a couple days, he declared a nationwide banking holiday. He shut down essentially all the banks for 4 business days. And during this, he gave one of his fireside chats. I believe it was his first fireside chat. And some people explain the success of FDR to these fireside chats. Economists don't know much about, you know, whether talking to people on the radio helps much. That's not our area of expertise. But he said, FDR told the American people, there are some bad banks out there, I'm going to shut down the worst ones, and then once the banks reopen, I'm going to make sure they stay safe. So you might think, well, maybe it's FDR telling people that things will be fine. That's what matters. Confidence. Confidence is what saved the day. He spoke confidently. What else did FDR do besides speaking confidently? He shut down one-third of U.S. banks. One-third. So once the extra two-thirds reopened, the American people decided, wow, this guy's serious. So There was an enormous flood of money back into the remaining banks. A lot of Americans were hoarding cash during those during the previous few years, actually. People holding green pieces of paper, literally stuffing them in their mattresses. That pretty much ended within about a few months of FDR closing one-third of U.S. banks. So in the U.S., we've been worried about declines in confidence if this bank goes bankrupt, or if that bank is forced into a merger, or if an investment bank buys up a weak bank. Every time that happens, we treat that as bad news. Strangely, FDR decided to treat that as good news. I'm shutting down the weak things, and so then the remaining things will be strong. So no less an authority on monetary history than Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in their excellent Monetary History of the United States. Friedman and Schwartz thought that this was a good idea. This was the big turnaround. It was a big deal to them. They looked at that and said, boy, FDR really got that basically right. So willingness to be the bad cop now is one feature that certainly distinguished FDR and is in that part of his response to the Great Depression. There are more that I could highlight, but this is in the short time. That's plenty right there. And it was a very big and a very important thing for helping to restore the health of the banking sector. Of course, every politician is a mixed bag, and so the pro-cartel policy also deserves, as far as we can tell now, a fair amount of share of the blame for the weak recovery. So, but, he was trying many things, and some of them worked. So our regulations and idea trap, just to give, not that this is the most important example of an idea trap, but that it's one that we have decent data on, and one that we'll probably be seeing more of over the next few years. So during bad times, does the government try out bad policies? Well, just to give you a sense of the cost of government regulation, John Cedar and his co-author at John Cedar at North Carolina State did an estimate where he basically counted up the pages in the Code of Federal Regulation and that were added each year. I believe it may have been each quarter, actually. I think it was each year. And he used that to see whether that was a decent predictor of how the economy did in the future. And he controlled for a number of factors. The big ones he controlled for were how the economy had been doing in the recent past, to sort of control for kind of business cycle effects. He controlled for tax rates, and he controlled for government spending. And he found that basically there did seem to be a long-run effect of the average page, not every page, but the average page, the average extra page in the Code of Federal Regulation seems to hurt the U.S. economy, seems to cost about $9.2 million in lost output on average. Now, this is a big picture macro story. I'm a macro economist by training, so I like these big picture stories. Microeconomists can really get in and say how this particular rule changed incentives and either helped or hurt an industry. They really get into the guts of things, and that's great stuff. A macro guy like Cedar comes and says, if I read that the government just added an extra 100 pages to the CFR this year, how does that change my prediction of how the economy is going to be 2, 3, 4 years out? How does that change my prediction? And so he gave a rough back-of-the-envelope estimate in the paper that said that the average American would have been about 10% richer if the CFR had stayed about the same length since 1955. So not a massive difference, but something, right? So this is roughly in line with estimates by other scholars. There's some estimates that come out of the OECD, some OECD data looking at Europe, Japan, a few other rich countries, and they come up with some similar estimates. So if the government does behave efficiently, then non-economic benefits for the average page in the CFR should be at least $9.2 million per page. So there are, of course, good, important non-economic benefits from government regulation. Fairness, shifting risk to people who are most able to bear it, raising quality of goods in ways that aren't really easy to measure. Our GDP measures are pretty crummy. So maybe some government safety rules for children's toys are raising output in a way that the government isn't really measuring with our GDP numbers. But this gives you an idea of what your hurdle rate ought to be, perhaps. So if government is passing efficient rules, then the things that don't show up have to be equal about $9.2 million per page to balance the things that do show up. So what eventually happened in Japan? Did they, they've had some better times, so what ultimately happened? So a lot of leading economists, both in Japan and around the world, did advise the Japanese government, and they gave it unpopular advice. So they said, do hard things, and the politicians said, we don't like to do hard things. So if you're really looking for people to read on this, the people I've been reading for the last decade, literally, like I've been keeping on and on, off and on track of their research, is Hoshi and Kashyap. Hoshi is at UC San Diego. He was actually in a different department from the department I was in, where I earned my degree, just down at the International Relations School. And Anil Kashyap is at University of Chicago. He's advised the Japanese government a lot, written a lot of great stuff. He's also written some important work, some op-eds recently about what the Japanese lessons are for the current financial crisis. So unsurprisingly, because we are the dismal science, our advice was ignored for years, partly because it was about saying you need to create some churn. Some of the policies that were proposed did involve basically, you know, shutting down the weakest banks, or merging them, or blowing off debt holders, or doing a cram down, turning debt into equity to recapitalize these firms privately. Most of what ultimately happened, the most successful parts of what happened, were a bank recapitalization, not entirely unlike what Secretary Paulson has come up with over the last couple of weeks. So, but it took about 10 years in Japan for them to come up with a recapitalization plan that was acceptable to the banks. The banks fought long and hard because when you're a bank, it's no fun to say, I'm going to have to pay big dividends to the government all the time. You're also concerned that this is a signal that you're an unhealthy bank if you take money from the government. So banks were very concerned about this, and it took them about 10 years to do it. It was eventually Prime Minister Koizumi who was elected, a big fan of Elvis, by the way. So when he came to the U.S., you may remember that he really wanted to go to Graceland. And so he did. So Koizumi eventually implemented much of these reforms, including a fairly successful bank recapitalization program. Now, Kashyap, in an op-ed said, when the U.S. considers a bank recapitalization plan, he recommended that it should be tied with getting debt holders to take some of the heat. So much of our current financial crisis is about an unwillingness to let debt holders, people who invested bought long-term bonds in these corporations and these banks, to lose money. We've been very unwilling to do that. And Kashyap says that he recommends that part of the Paulson plan, or part of some secondary or tertiary Paulson plan, should be that when the government comes in and invests, it should act informally as a bankruptcy judge and do what a bankruptcy judge would do in a similar setting, which is to say, you guys aren't really sound right now, but you're a good business. You just don't have enough money to pay off your bondholders. So there's nothing wrong with being a good business that doesn't have enough money to pay off your bondholders. It's just that it's time to be honest and tell them you're not going to be able to give them all their money. One thing you can do in return is do what we do sometimes in Chapter 7, sometimes in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, is turn some of those long-term bonds into shares in the company. And Kashyap says that that should be the sort of a prerequisite for these bank recapitalizations. Why? Because it gets private money coming in. So all the money isn't just coming from taxpayers. More extreme example of this comes from Luigi Zingales, also at University of Chicago, who thinks that basically converting debt to equity is enough to solve the vast majority of the U.S. Financial problem. These firms have plenty of value. It's just that we're calling that value, they have plenty of capital. It's just that we're calling that capital debt right now. If you just, use your magic bankruptcy judge pen, you can turn that debt into equity. By converting debt into equity, that is one way to recapitalize these firms. This seems to be a crisis of undercapitalized banks, but largely what this crisis is a crisis of mislabeled capital. The debt right now could easily be labeled as equity, getting more people caring about the long-run health of these firms. So the Japanese plan of bank recapitalization, while was a step in the right direction. So even doing a step in the right direction was quite costly for Koizumi. He did have a finance minister who was a prominent economist actually give a talk and an interview where he said, no bank is too big to fail. This was a huge shock to the Japanese financial system to hear that no bank is too big to fail. And that seemed to be bad news for banks, but it was good news for markets. So So since the Japanese have implemented a recapitalization program that came with some strings attached, and it encouraged banks to be more honest in writing down their loans and being willing to making banks more willing to say, yes, we have some bad loans and we're not going to renew them, this has weakened the power of the zombies a bit. Another thing the Japanese have done is brought in more foreign competition, more foreign banks that came in and weren't beholden to the Japanese government and its encouragement of zombie creation. And so more finance has flowed over to those other new non-zombie banks. And a strange and possibly sad thing for the Japanese economy is that big firms in Japan just stopped using banks. They started going directly to financial markets or borrowing money, sometimes opening their own banks. They basically just stopped using the Japanese financial networks and instead found their own forms of financing, often by going directly to folks through the equivalent of commercial paper markets, bond markets. So will we do better than the Japanese? Of course, it's too early to tell, right? One hopeful lesson is that at least getting to the level of bank recapitalization, which is politically unpopular, took the U.S. about a year. It took the Japanese about 10 years to get to a modestly successful bank capitalization program. There will certainly be strong tendencies, as you can imagine, to sort of keep hope alive in these firms by encouraging banks to keep lending to the firms that they have ongoing relationships with, and that will tend to create a mini form of zombification. So it's clear that Bernanke and Paulson, as far as we can tell, are very concerned with not creating zombies. And part of the way they've addressed this question for example, with the preferred shares, for the first couple of years for the first couple of years, these preferred shares have to pay a 5% dividend to the government. And then after that, they have to pay a 10% annual dividend to the government. So they've already set up a system to try to make it unpopular for these banks to hold on to these things. So banks will want to get out of this system. So they are trying to behave in a fairly time inconsistent way. They're trying to tie their own hands so that the banks will want to get these shares off of their books as soon as possible and turn back into regular private sector banks without government aid. Of course, the question will be, when that time comes, will Congress and will the White House renegotiate? That's always a very tempting thing for government to do. It's always difficult to pull the plug because in a world of churn, in a world of dynamism, outcomes are very unpredictable. And it's very difficult for many politicians to be willing to take that step into the void, and be willing to let the unpredictable nature of capitalism just take its course. So I can take some questions. I've got a few minutes here.
I just wanted to, before we do questions, make two math. One, if you can fill out those great surveys, it helps us to track the quality of our courses and make sure we do a good job. And second, I'm going to apologize for all the administration issues we've been having online and subsequent catering issues that we've been having. It's causing an inconvenience for you guys. So I'm going to go back to straight email registration for a little while so we can work out the problem. But I do want to let you know that we're aware of it and we apologize. So. Any questions?
Yeah, please.
Was the cost of the Japanese financial crisis, was it primarily from the real estate bubble, or were there other causes? Is it similar arts back since it was started by that?
Now, they did have a collapse in their stock markets a couple of years before. Let me repeat the question first, which is, what was the key cause of the Japanese bubble? Was it the collapse in real estate values? And that there was an equity crisis that started 3 years before, but it seems as though the collapse of the land bubble was really, very important. So it put a lot of banks in situations where they had a lot of bad loans. Same story as we're in. A lot of banks with a lot of bad loans. Nobody wants to let those banks go down. So let's put them on life support. And banks on life support just aren't that efficient. I mean, you've probably known people on life support. They aren't that healthy. They don't get that much done. So yeah, it's very similar to ours in that you can spend a lot of time on the differences, right? But the key fact is that once there are these underwater mortgages, somebody's not going to get paid. I think that's the key fact. It kind of doesn't matter that much who it is, as long as it's somebody who's deeply connected to the rest of the financial system. So in the U.S., it's been insurers, and it's been investment banks, and to some extent, retail banks. In Japan, it tended to be their big banks, but their banking system is more integrated, where there's a blurry line between investment and retail. So, yes?
You've done a great job at pointing out the similarities, but the unprecedented crisis, when I read that in the newspapers, they're not talking about this. They're talking about credit default swaps.
Yeah.
Which are basically insurance against debt in case the mortgages
go yes.
down. Among other things, it's about $50 to $60 trillion in value.
CDS market.
And it's in the scale and scope. Just to give you an idea, that's more than the entire GDP year of the entire globe. Corporate debt is about $6 trillion. Mortgage debt is about $7.5 trillion. So much of the they're so much larger. These insurance side bets, if you will, are so much larger than what they're meant to insure. And that's the unprecedented crisis, I think. And I don't know that any of this that they're. I mean, AIG is an example where they acted to prevent those things from unraveling and everything. But what kinds of things do you think government should do to bolster the financial system? LIBOR was at a record rate for the last few weeks. How do you solve the financial crisis without bailing out the insolvent banks?
Well, let me emphasize that I really think the key problem is, I think the CDS issue is relatively speaking a side issue, because the same story is true, which is that somebody won't get paid. So these banks that held risky debt, so there are banks that held risky debt and then said, I'm going to buy insurance from AIG that will insure me in case these guys don't pay. Well, all they did is they shifted the risk over to AIG. Well, they thought they shifted the risk over to AIG, but they really didn't. Well, or maybe they will. It's hard to tell how big the bailout's going
to
be, right?
They
shifted to Uncle Sam, I suppose. So it turned out that those people did make very smart decisions to buy insurance from AIG, right? Because they were really buying insurance from the government. They just didn't know it at the time. If they're getting bailed out, I still think the same story is that somebody's not going to get paid. And whether it's AIG not getting paid and their network of relationships getting blown up, whether it's AIG having debts they didn't know they had, much bigger than they thought they had, or whether it's a run-of-the-mill bank that has some people paying slow on their mortgages, it's still some financial institution that was part of a big financial network is going to be crippled. And our question is, are we going to help those guys? I think the Zingales approach, the cash gap approach of speed bankruptcy, where you convert debt to equity, is a way to recapitalize a lot of these banks and restore trust. I think a big problem is that when you are underwater in your mortgage, when people are underwater in their mortgage, they make bad decisions, right? And when firms are underwater because their debt commitments are bigger than the value of the firm, they make bad decisions, right? So we don't trust folks who are underwater in their mortgages, and we don't trust shareholders who are underwater in their firms. So one way to, you know, fix this problem is to the reason people keep talking about recapitalization is because firms that are well capitalized feel like they have money in the game. If I win, heads I win, tails I lose. If my firm is very undercapitalized, then what I feel like is heads I win, tails I hand it over to the debt holders. So well-capitalized firms feel like every dollar they lose is a dollar coming out of their own pocket. So getting banks, getting financial institutions, whether it's investment banks or retail banks, recapitalized is, I think, at the center of this crisis. And like I said, there's plenty of capital sitting around. We're just calling it debt right now. That's the Zingales approach. Yes? Oh. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these people, a lot of people have insurance. A lot of people are going to find out they didn't have insurance. Yeah.
The history of finances has a $60 trillion obligation that can't be fulfilled. I mean, that's a big difference from what happened in Japan.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, so a lot of people. But it is that. But what's going to turn out to be the case is that a lot of people are going to find out they didn't have insurance.
But they
thought they were paying for insurance, and so the risk is back on them. So I paid a lot of premiums for my car insurance, and then I made a claim, and my company was gone.
So $60 trillion. So the entire. I mean, do you think that's not too big for government to act to sort of bolster that and keep that system in place?
Well, I mean,
look at LIBOR. Look what happened to LIBOR. People thought those things were, you know, there's no trust in the market. These things.
Yeah, I think trust in the market is caused by undercapitalization. I think that's the key. I think the standard story from the last 20 years of corporate finance, the sort of Hart, Moore, Holmstrom, Tyrol approach, is that capitalization is the real problem. So people who have, I mean, a lot of, I guess I can do is just keep repeating myself, which is that, like, so these insurance companies that are not going to be able to pay off these things. Yeah. Yeah. And so people who thought they had insurance just don't have it now. Any other questions? All right. Well, thanks.